can manage this relationship because we control the oil supply. And Hussein's response was, no, I'm going to invade Kuwait.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver Fox, joined by John Allen Gay, as we have a conversation with Dr. Gregory Brew. A quick note, JQAS is holding our summer conference in mid-July. If you're a student, including master's or PhD, or a young professional with less than 2 years of experience in foreign policy, we encourage you to apply. If selected, we'll fly you to Washington, D.C., and you can hear from keynote speakers, scholars in grand strategy, and more awesome programming. But back to today's show. Dr. Brew is an analyst at the Eurasia Group and a researcher on the formation of the global oil economy and contemporary energy transition. He's joining us to talk about oil markets and how they affect modern national security questions, like America's embargo on Russia and Houthi disruption of Red Sea oil flows. Join us for our conversation with Dr. Gregory Brew.
Greg Brew, welcome to Security Dilemma. In your recent War on the Rocks piece, Red Sea Shocks and the New More Stable Normal that you wrote back in February, this I really have to recommend that people read this piece because when I read it, I was very surprised by your conclusions. It was something I hadn't thought about. It really challenged my assumptions. And because it was coming from, you know, someone who I know knows more about this stuff than I do, I was like, okay, like I better take this pretty seriously. So you said energy relationships that used to inject risk and volatility into the global economy, like European dependence on Russia or U.S. dependence on the Middle East, have now largely been replaced by relationships tying like-minded states together through channels that largely avoid strategic choke points. The Red Sea crisis, rather than the beginning of a new era of instability, could mark such an era's end and the transition to a new and perhaps more stable normal. And this is a phenomenon you call in this piece the great de-risking. So what's going on?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on, John. It's a pleasure to chat with you today. And yeah, I mean, you are correct. The conclusion is a little counterintuitive. It's maybe even a little provocative. So I'm glad that it's catching your attention and it's starting this discussion. So yes, so it sort of stemmed from my analysis of the Red Sea crisis in the context of what's been happening to the global geopolitics of energy over the last several years. And of course, this isn't the first crisis that we've seen in energy. First, there was the COVID shock, which caused a crash in oil prices in early 2020. There was a brief moment where the price of oil went negative in Texas. People were paying people to take their oil from them. And then, of course, we had Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, which caused a pretty dramatic price spike. Prices went over $100 a barrel and stayed there for several months. This caused a pretty significant energy crunch. There, of course, were knock-on effects in gas markets as well, because natural gas was also heavily affected. And then we have the Red Sea crisis, which stems from the broader Middle East crisis resulting from Hamas's attack on Israel, but of course stems specifically from Houthi attacks against commercial shipping in the Red Sea. So this isn't the first crisis that the global energy market has faced in the last several years, but it is one that has compounded trends that were pre-existing, that trends that go back to not only to the previous crises from COVID and Russia's war in Ukraine, but from an earlier period, really stretching back over the last 10 years. And it's produced what I call the great de-risking, because it's produced a shift in the flows of energy globally. Now, the shift comes from commercial changes, right? The energy industry is an industry. It is first and foremost a commercial entity driven by, cost-benefit analysis, driven by profit, driven by producers trying to find the best market for their product. These are commercial relationships. Energy industry operates like any other. But of course, the energy industry is also heavily influenced by geopolitics. And geopolitics has played an increasing role, I would argue, in managing or changing or directing the flow of energy over the last several years. So what we've seen, as I emphasize in the piece, is energy is now being pushed into two large bands, two large channels. The first channel has been around for a while, but has become more important, and that's the channel connecting the Persian Gulf to East Asia, particularly China. China is the world's largest oil importer. It has been for quite some time. It will continue to be for quite some time, even as it embraces the energy transition, even as China accelerates the growth of EVs, other energy transition technologies. China requires a great deal of oil. And while it does produce some domestically, it needs even more to be imported. A lot of that oil comes from the Persian Gulf. From the point of view of Persian Gulf producers, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, Iraq, their big market is not west, it is east. So when they think about their bottom line, when they think about the future of their oil products, their energy products, they're thinking primarily about their customers in Asia. So that's the first big channel. And of course, this is a channel which, you know, I should note, geographically avoids the Red Sea. Middle East energy cargoes to their largest consuming markets don't go anywhere near the Houthis. They don't go near the Red Sea. They pass through the Strait of Hormuz and then they move east. So that's the first big channel. The second channel is the more surprising and I would argue more significant one, and that's in the North Atlantic, connecting energy production in North America, primarily the United States, although Canada's in there as well, to the large energy consuming markets in Europe. And this is a shift that comes from two big changes that we've seen over the last 10 years, one commercial, the other geopolitical. The commercial is the rise of the United States, or I should say the resurgence of the United States, as a major fossil fuel exporter. It's always produced a lot of fossil fuels, but over the last several years, it has become a net exporter, not only of oil, but also critically of natural gas and refined products. And a lot of these products are now going to Europe. And the big reason for that is Russia's war in Ukraine and the sanctions that have been placed on Russia that have effectively blocked it from the European market. So these are big changes that have happened over the last 10 years that stem from commercial motives, but also from geopolitical factors. And they've resulted in a shift within the global energy market that has moved energy away from choke points like the Red Sea, like the Bab al-Mandeb. So the result has been, while the crisis in the Red Sea has been quite disruptive, particularly to commercial container ship traffic, as far as the energy market goes, it was relatively easy to absorb, and it's been relatively easy to move beyond. I read energy market coverage every day. I follow the oil market very, very closely. And I can tell you that as far as the market's concerned, the Red Sea story is basically done at this point.
So maybe just to push a bit on that, the kind of counter narrative that I grew up with on global oil markets is oil's a fairly fungible commodity. You know, a barrel of oil from Saudi Arabia is pretty much like a barrel of oil from Texas. And therefore, because it's also globally traded, you can take oil from one place and in theory, you can kind of sell it anywhere, that price shocks in one of these regions are going to affect prices pretty fundamentally in the other region, which would imply like even if the flows have changed, it's still a global market where like if you're sitting in the White House, you start getting sweats and chills if you hear about a disruption in the Strait of Hormuz or something like that. Is that still the case?
Absolutely. And there we can get a little bit more granular and we can talk about, you know, security and risk. We can talk about that and we can talk about price. I mean, the global nature of the oil market hasn't changed, right? Markets are still heavily interconnected, even if there has been this shift into these two large channels that I'm emphasized. But the interconnected global nature of the oil market and the fact that risk is still perceived to exist is the reason why the price of oil today is $89, $90 a barrel rather than $70, $75 a barrel. There is risk premium that are sort of baked into the price structure that stem from the Middle East crisis, that stem from Russia's war in Ukraine. And it's the reason why oil, it gets a little bit more expensive when these crises break out, when these disruptive episodes occur. For precisely the reason that you mentioned, it remains a globally integrated market. What's changed, however, is a shift away from choke points. So the Strait of Hormuz remains the sort of critical choke point due to the geography of the Persian Gulf, right? So much of the world's oil comes from the fields of the Persian Gulf. And while Saudi Arabia has a pipeline that cuts across the length of its country from, you know, its oil fields in the east to the Red Sea, which allows it to move a certain amount of oil away from the Strait of Hormuz. If the Strait were closed, most Saudi, Emirati, Kuwaiti, and Iraqi supply would be shut in. And there you're talking about, you know, 20% of global seaborne crude supply. It would be a massive amount. It would be an incredibly disruptive episode for global oil markets. What we've seen over the last several years, however, is that the market And those participating in the market, tanker companies, traders, oil companies, national governments, have gotten quite good at managing the volatility. I mean, you mentioned like the narrative we've all grown up with, which is the narrative that our parents grew up with, is the story of the 1970s, right? Oil was very stable. The price was stable. Then suddenly it wasn't. And we all had to get used to this world where oil was under threat, was under risk, could be disrupted, was volatile. The volatility has now been baked into everyone's analysis for 50 years. So traders, market analysts, oil companies have gotten quite good at managing volatility. They've gotten quite good at absorbing risky events. The Red Sea is actually a pretty good example. You know, when the Houthi attack started in November, container shippers like Maersk and others were very quick to say, we're going to go around. We're going to avoid the Red Sea. We don't want to take on the risk of Houthi attacks. Tanker companies, oil traders, were much more risk tolerant. They were willing to send their ships through for a longer period of time. The change in tanker traffic through the Red Sea, it did change. There has been a reduction in the number of tankers that go through, but it was a much longer tail as far as how the traffic fell off, as opposed to container shipping, which left immediately. And that gives you a sense of the varying levels of risk tolerance in different parts of the shipping industry. When it came to moving tankers, there's much more willingness to take on risk because that's what they're used to. They're used to volatility. They're used to risk. The container shippers were a little bit more spooked by the Houthi threat to traffic through the Red Sea. So some of this comes from history. Some of this comes from just how the industry has grown over the last half century. It's not the world of the 1970s anymore. We've gotten a little bit better at managing these kinds of events. And even big seismic disruptions like Russia's war in Ukraine, which many people thought was going to be extremely difficult to manage, particularly for Europe, ended up being expensive, but not quite as cataclysmic as some had anticipated.
Yeah, and just to keep digging here, in your piece in War on the Rocks, one of the lines is commerce invariably adjusts to disruptions and markets stabilize around a new normal. And I'm curious how someone in, say, national security world in D.C. should think about this. Because, for instance, Eugene Goltz at the University of Notre Dame has, in some of his old work on oil markets, highlighted various ways in which markets adjust, bringing on new supply, rerouting supplies, et cetera, to offset fairly quickly some of these shocks to the oil market, which he says, okay, like we should probably be less concerned with securitizing and securing the oil flows internationally. And then I've talked about this scholarship with other folks. They say, yeah, but if you're a politician, you know, a 3-month disruption in the oil price is still a big, big deal, even if it's going to sort itself out eventually. So how should like DC people be thinking about this?
Yeah, this is a great question. And it gets to an issue that I actually quite enjoy talking about, which is the issue of time. Time matters very differently to folks working in energy, particularly energy production, energy exploration, as opposed to people who work in national security. You know, when you talk to people who work in the oil industry, particularly, you know, conventional drillers or offshore, they'll say like, oh, it'll take 10 years to develop this find, right? You do the exploration, you sink your wells, you develop the field, you pump more capital in, you establish the infrastructure that you need, and then you start producing. And it can take years and years until you reach a level where you're producing at commercial levels. Now, when you talk about a disruption, right, a disruption in energy traffic, energy shipping, or supply, the market always adjusts. We've seen this over the course of the last 100 years. You know, there have been multiple energy shocks, not just the energy shocks of the 70s or 80s, but shocks going back to World War I or the 1920s or the 1930s, where we faced an oil supply glut. You know, markets do tend to adjust. Because the costs imposed by maintaining the status quo become too great to shoulder. You have to adjust. But the problem, as you note, for politicians and also for national security practitioners is that you're looking at a much different timeline. So if you're a politician, 6 months of high gas prices is going to damage you. It's going to limit your ability to secure re-election. It's going to constrain your ability to carry out the rest of your political agenda. It's also going to potentially weaken the national economy, weaken not only your position, but the position of, you know, other members of your political party and of the nation as a whole. So that's a concern. When you're a national security practitioner, a short-term shock, while manageable for markets, could be very disruptive for geopolitical relationships, for actors on the ground. You can't anticipate actors to accept change over the course of 3 to 6 months or a year when they see costs being imposed on them in the short term. An example of that would be, you know, Saddam Hussein leaving the Iran-Iraq war in 1988 with immense debts to other Arab states. And he had no way to sort of pay off these debts. And the anticipation from the Arab states was, well, we'll pressure Iraq into, you know, working with us on terms that we'll set. We can pay that, you know, we can manage this relationship because we control the oil supply. And Hussein's response was, no, I'm going to invade Kuwait because that makes more sense to me to solve my short term problem. So when it comes to, you know, managing national security and politics, the timelines are shorter. Timelines are narrower and can be more difficult to manage. And that's where something like energy policy can become very useful. And by energy policy, I mean things like the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or pursuing energy diversification, or pursuing the energy transition. I mean, a question in national discourse over the next 10 to 20 years is going to be, should we care as much about the price of gasoline now that we're consuming less of it? As we encourage the adoption of electric vehicles and our national gasoline consumption starts to decline, will this political salience of the price of gasoline remain as high as it is currently? I mean, these are conversations that we're probably going to have at some point and will matter both to domestic politics and ultimately to the national security discussion.
I'd love to have a little bit of that conversation.
Let's do it.
We have a lot of exploration about the advent of renewable energy as a killing blow for the strategic importance of regions like the Persian Gulf. And I forget where I heard this, but there's some little line about how the last drop of oil will be drilled from a Saudi well because it's so cheap to get it out there. What's going on here? How might renewable energy technology affect these markets and, by extent, geopolitics in the sort of short to medium term?
Right. So the energy transition, I should say, is happening, right? It's without question. Energy mixes are changing. Power mixes are changing. Electrification is happening on a grand scale. It's happening at a very accelerated pace in China, which is arguably the most important energy market in the world as far as watching global trends. The United States is a little strange because we consume a lot of energy, but we also produce an immense amount of energy as well. So we're not quite on the same scale. But when you're looking at how the energy transition is proceeding in China, in the EU, in other G7 countries, and then also in the global south, it's absolutely happening. And it will have an impact on oil demand. The question is how quickly that impact is felt and how it's measured out in actual global oil demand. So demand for things like gasoline will peak quite soon and will start to go down simply due to the rate at which electrification is having an impact on transportation fuel demand. Demand for middle distillates, things like heating oil, diesel, they may not peak, but they may level off quite soon, in large part due to the changes happening in China and other emerging economies. So I don't think it's really up for debate that we're looking at a peak in global oil demand in the short term. What does that mean for the significance of the Persian Gulf? Well, when you talk to anybody from the Persian Gulf, someone from Saudi, from the UAE, from Kuwait, they're actually very positive about this question because they see themselves at the forefront of the energy transition. They see their states as pursuing these new technologies, as embracing the energy transition, things like carbon capture and storage, hydrogen, renewable energy, solar. These are all things that they're very optimistic about. They're very active about. When it comes to managing that with their crude oil or their fossil fuel production, it's precisely, as you say, Patrick, they think, and they're probably right, that they will remain the producers of last resort for the foreseeable future. I mean, when we talk about peak oil demand, we're talking about going from 102 million barrels a day to 100 million barrels a day. In 50 years, maybe we're looking at 60 to 70 million barrels a day. That's still a lot of oil, and it has to come from somewhere. And OPEC and OPEC's leaders are pretty confident that they're going to continue to be the main suppliers of that oil through the rest of this century. So from them, from their point of view, it's kind of a win-win. You know, they can use their revenues that they're making now to develop their economies, to pursue the energy transition, to be leaders in that field, while also remaining the world's most important supplier of fossil fuels for the foreseeable future. As they see it, peak oil demand will come. It will lead to a decline in oil demand, but they will continue to be the most important supplier.
How might this play out in a continent like Africa, where you have fairly undeveloped or early stage energy consumption markets, I suppose? Like electric vehicles might not be cheaper than gasoline powered vehicles in a place like Africa for much longer than they would be in China or America. I'm curious just in general, I guess, what role Africa is playing in energy politics. Are they primarily consumers, producers? How's that all changing?
Well, this is actually a really, really great question, because when you break things down, when you break things down as far as energy production, you've got your big players. You've got Saudi, Russia, the United States. Then you've got sort of slightly smaller producers, Canada, Norway, the UK still produces a lot of oil. China produces oil, although all of it's for domestic consumption. Brazil, obviously, Malaysia, these other states. When you break it down, when you get to the next tier, you've got dozens of countries, a lot of them, in fact, almost all of them in the global south, and a lot of them in sub-Saharan Africa, that produce reasonably large volumes of crude oil. They produce it for domestic consumption. They produce it for sale, since selling crude oil is an excellent way to earn foreign exchange, as it's all sold in dollars, almost all of it anyway. So these are lots of producers that produce on the margins. And one of the bigger questions, I think, is what will happen to these producers when we do hit a peak oil demand scenario? And you're starting to see it play out in places like Mozambique or even in Nigeria, which is a very large oil producer, where the confidence in exploring new oil fields is starting to wane. Because the concern is, will we be able to compete with OPEC or with the United States, with shale drillers in the US? Will we be able to compete in an environment where the market is getting smaller, where demand is starting to shrink, where the energy transition is accelerating, and where competition with oil and with oil products is starting to grow? There, the concern is some of these smaller producers might start to get squeezed out. And now it'll be a long process, because in many cases, they're subsidized. They're supported by national governments. Almost most of the oil in the world is produced by companies that are owned by states, by national oil companies, as opposed to private oil companies. So there's state support for these kinds of programs. But at the same time, smaller states in sub-Saharan Africa are looking to embrace the energy transition, because they need sources of cheap energy. They need sources of power. Wind and solar continue to become more competitive. They continue to be fairly cheap to install, particularly solar. So the energy transition is going to play out in messy ways, particularly in the global south. And your point about, you know, EVs being more expensive. Now, I'm not so sure that in a couple years you won't see cheaper EVs than internal combustion engine cars, for the simple reason that major auto manufacturers aren't going to be making as many ICE cars as they're making currently. They're going to be shifting to greater EV production, in parts in order to compete in the larger consuming markets. The Chinese have obviously gotten very, very good at producing large numbers of cheap EVs. The Indians are not far behind them. I know that there's considerable interest in India to produce cheap EVs that they can market in global South countries to compete with China. So this is going to be a big story moving forward, is how India and China compete for EV sales in emerging markets, because the energy transition is happening everywhere. But the way it's going to play out in oil is going to be very interesting, because there are lots of marginal producers in the global south that could get squeezed out as oil demand starts to peak and then starts to decline.
One of the things you said on Twitter the other day that caught my eye is you basically said people give too much significance to the spot price of oil. You know, things like that you'll see in the news, the Brent crude or West Texas Intermediate, you know, how many dollars per barrel it is. What do you mean by that? And like, how do you assess trends in the oil market, if not by those kind of big, high profile metrics?
Glad someone's reading my Twitter profile. No, I think it sort of speaks to the continued, what I mentioned before, the continued political salience of the price of gasoline in the United States, which people connect to the price of crude oil. I think it's why the price of crude oil continues to get as much attention as it does, because its connection to the price of transportation fuel. And that is, you know, we can argue the precise percentages of, you know, household consumption costs coming out of transportation, right? How much does the price of gasoline really affect the bottom line for the average American consumer? It varies over time. It is a percentage of household costs. So it does, quote unquote, matter. Whether it matters as much as medical expenses, housing, food, student loans, you know, that can be up for debate. But it's always seemed to me that the price of gasoline is given more significance than it really merits. And I think that's largely the result of politics and history, right? It's the long shadow of the 1970s continuing to loom large over our national energy discussion, our national energy discourse. It's why the Biden administration in 2022, you know, it reacted to the energy shock from Russia, in part by pushing forward a clean energy agenda, which made a lot of sense, right? We diversify away from fossil fuels so that we're not exposed to this kind of volatility. But in more immediate terms, the more important thing for the administration to do was to flood the market with more oil to get the price of gasoline down before the midterms. That was the important thing. So long as this continues to be regarded as important, it will be treated as important. But for me, there are more important metrics when it comes to measuring the price of energy. The price of electricity is more important than the price of gasoline because everyone consumes electricity. We're consuming it right now. Me sitting in this this little booth talking to you right now, we're consuming power. You only consume gasoline when you hop in your car. So why don't we care about energy markets the same way we care about the oil market? Lots of reasons. The energy market's more complicated, but it doesn't get as much attention. It tends to be more regional. It tends to be more, it tends to be structured and managed differently. Utilities are concerned about lots of different things. There also isn't this, I think, fascination with electricity markets because the electricity market doesn't get attached to geopolitical events or geopolitical episodes the same way the oil market does. The oil market is a great thing for newspapers to publish stories on because it's always going to get attention, right? Crisis in the Middle East, the price of oil could go up. It's a very, very easy headline because it's one that's imbued with significance, political imagination, and history. But as we proceed through the energy transition, I would argue we should be spending a lot more time worrying about the price of electricity, the price of power, and the price of heating. And I will note that from where I'm sitting, our friends in Europe are ahead of us in this. They have to worry a lot more about the price of electricity and the price of heating since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because their most significant supplier of energy has now been pushed away, right? They have to look to the future. They have to look to new sources of power. It's going to be an enormous question facing the future of Europe, where its energy, where its power is going to come from. So these are the issues that, you know, we should be discussing. They're maybe not quite as fun to do. I love to talk about the price of oil. You know, it's part of my job, but it does sometimes strike me as some misplaced attention that could be better placed elsewhere.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Biden administration flooding the market, and that was through a release from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And now there's been some kind of buzz on like conservative Twitter about, hey, they're not going to refill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve like they said they would. Is this making us less safe? Is that something that like people should be paying a lot of attention to, like precise SPR levels? The SPR in general, because like we don't have like a mohair stockpile anymore.
No, although we could. Why not? Pay as much attention to the SPR as you want. It's something that I pay attention to, but it's a nerdy thing that I'm interested in. I think the discourse around the SPR obviously became politicized following the administration's release of oil in 2022. I don't think that's really any surprise. But I would argue that the administration used the SPR for its intended purpose, which was to absorb the shock from an increase in the price of oil, right? This often gets at the fine distinction that people make about what the SPR is designed to do. The SPR isn't just designed to mitigate a supply disruption, which, by the way, I should note, everyone expected in 2022. Everyone expected a supply disruption. There was broad expectations that Russian oil exports would decline as the result of Western sanctions and the war in Ukraine. That didn't really end up happening, but there was broad expectation of it. And the idea is that you use the SPR in advance to absorb the shock from a supply disruption. Because if you wait until the supply disruption has happened, then, you know, you've missed the boat. The shock has come and you've already had to absorb the pain. But not just from a supply disruption, the SPR is also about managing price. It is a price management tool. Even if people don't really want to acknowledge it, that's its purpose. Because that is ultimately the legacy of the 1970s energy shocks. Most of the attention was on managing the price of oil. So as far as, you know, using the SPR, yes, we released a lot of oil from the SPR. We did it at a strategic moment during a period of very, very high price. And then the administration had plans to refill it during a period of low price. But of course, the price of oil changes. And now the price is around $90 a barrel. It's quite expensive. The SPR does have a statute that requires the administration to manage it in a way that produces profit for the American people. So they're actually not allowed to sell the oil at a higher price or at a lower price at which they then refill the reserve. So the decision to postpone refilling it, at least in the short term, makes a certain amount of sense so long as these prices remain high. But I don't think it's really any surprise that the SPR has become politicized, since virtually every facet of American energy policy has become politicized at this point. Though I would argue the SPR was used quite effectively and was used broadly in line with its design.
Related Biden administration energy decision that's gotten a lot of question marks and discussion going is their move that blocked an LNG terminal down in Louisiana. And they spoke about this in terms of climate. And, you know, my immediate reaction was, wow, you know, this is totally in tension with their goal of helping the Europeans de-Russify their energy supply. You know, that the Europeans are really excited about LNG, and America is becoming a big supplier for that, and it gives them options other than buying from Russia. So, you know, it felt like the two sides of the administration, the domestic side, the environmental side, and the international side, were like at odds. And it, I mean, frankly, I thought like, wow, this seems like a bad decision. But I'm curious what you thought when you heard about this LNG decision. Did you expect it? How do you piece all this together?
Sure thing. First and foremost, it's not unprecedented for, you know, U.S. domestic energy policy to be at odds with U.S. foreign policy. I could run through a few examples, but it's been frequently the case that, you know, what the United States perceives as being in its national security interests or in the interests of its allies very often meets opposition from domestic energy related interests, be they producer interests or consumer interests. So it can be hard to get everybody to march to the same tune. But to your question, like, you know, what does this suggest about the administration's policy? I tend to take this view. I tend to see that the United States has two pro-fossil fuel political parties. One is a little embarrassed about it. So the Democratic Party has a fairly sizable, fairly vocal, and quite powerful wing that is very, very conscious of climate change, that is very conscious of carbon emissions, that doesn't like the fact that the United States has resurged as a major fossil fuel producer and now a major fossil fuel exporter. And they want to put limits on that. They want to limit the ability of the United States to export fossil fuels. The Biden administration, as far as I can tell, does not want to limit U.S. fossil fuel exports, but it is conscious of serving and assuaging the concerns of that particular wing of the party. Hence this decision that was taken this year to pause permitting of new LNG export terminals pending a more comprehensive review of the environmental impact of those terminals. It is my expectation that in the event of President Biden's reelection, this pause will end quite quickly because it will have served its purpose. I think this is largely a political move designed to lock down support from this wing of the Democratic Party so that in the event of President Biden's reelection, he can go to every member of the party and he can say, look, we're continuing to pursue a diversified energy policy. Yes, we're producing a lot of oil and gas, but we're also producing a lot of, you know, wind and solar. We want to move more quickly on EVs. The IRA is providing thousands of new jobs. You know, we're building out our manufacturing capacity. We're building out our critical mineral capacity. All of these things are happening and all of these things are good. So I think the move on LNG exports, you're absolutely right. It seems to fly in the face of U.S. national security interests and the interests of U.S. allies, particularly in Europe. But it does serve a domestic political purpose. And in an election year, I think that that takes first seat. I think Biden needs to be conscious of winning the election before he can be conscious of how much gas the United States has to sell to Europe. But we're already selling them quite a lot, right? That gets to a bigger question here, which is that how many more LNG export terminals does the United States really need, right? Do we need 10 more? Do we need 4 more? How much more market is there for U.S. liquefied natural gas? Is it going to grow the way that some of the more optimistic oil and gas producers seem to anticipate? Perhaps there is some case to be made for pausing new terminals so that the market readiness can be assessed and the growth expectations for American gas can be can be taken into account before we do, before we build out a lot of energy export infrastructure that we may not need in a decade or two.
You mentioned earlier how the global oil market is in dollars, and that's something that also comes up in national security circles now and then. You will hear about, the United States needs to be solicitous of Saudi Arabia so that Saudi will sell oil in dollars in order to support our economy. More recently, there's been concern that they might start selling oil in Chinese currency. And there's talk that this could be something we could get if we make a big deal with them, this kind of Biden-Saudi-Israel deal that's been floated, that one of the concessions we would seek from them is to guarantee, permanent dollar sale of oil. And I've spoken to some other folks who say that would be a genuine win, implying it's a genuine threat that we should actually be concerned about. I mean, why is oil sold in dollars? How is it going to stay that way? And how important is that to Americans? How much should we be willing to pay to keep it that way?
Sure. So it's a great question. Your first question, why is oil sold in dollars? I could give you a very, very long answer, or I could just say the Marshall Plan. That's really the biggest reason. It's the biggest reason. The Bretton Woods financial system that was constructed in the aftermath of World War II, the incorporation of Middle East oil to supply Europe and Japan in a reconstruction during the 1950s, the crucial role that was played by U.S. oil companies managing the flow of that energy. All of that was done in dollars. Flash forward 40 years, Saudi Arabia and other major OPEC states are nationalizing their oil industries. They are sort of taking over the oil production, but they're still working with American companies. They're financializing as well. There's been a broader sort of financialization of the oil market. And dollars were the dominant currency. They were the reserve currency, and they were the currency that the oil producers were already using. So it's a bit of history. And it's been sort of locked in place so long as the United States continues to be the world's largest and sort of most dominant financial power. To your question, does it matter what currency Saudi sells its oil? Yes and no. So Saudi sells a lot of oil to China. It's going to continue to sell a lot of oil to China for a bunch of reasons. One of the major reasons is that Saudi is paying for large downstream assets inside China, refineries, petrochemical factories, that sort of thing, so that they have a market locked in for their crude. They can sell a set amount of crude to China. China will buy it, process it into refined products with Saudi Arabian cooperation. So managing that trade in RMB or yuan makes sense if it's a strong sort of bilateral connection. When you take that volume and set it against the volume of oil being sold in the global market, it's not a drop in the bucket, but it's not a lot, right? Saudi Arabia is an important player on the global market because it still acts as the quote-unquote swing producer. So it's a significant move. But as far as suggesting that all oil trade is about to be de-dollarized or that the dollar will lose its dominant status as the currency in which most, if not all, oil is traded globally, it doesn't suggest that that would happen, certainly not immediately, because there are so many other bilateral relationships that are managed entirely in dollars involving oil from dozens of other oil producers. I think when it gets to the U.S.-Saudi relationship, oil is always the fuzzy point when you have these kinds of conversations, right? There are usually more concrete discussions around things like the security guarantee, Saudi normalization with Israel, even U.S. support for a Saudi Arabian civilian nuclear program. These discussions tend to be a little bit more concrete. Things get fuzzier when you get to oil, I think for two reasons. The first is that oil is ostensibly what it's all about, even though it's really not anymore. Right? The U.S.-Saudi relationship, I would argue, is about a lot more than just oil, given the weight of history, given the state of the region, given just inertia. And given U.S. interests in trying to counter China, other geopolitical concerns, what is going to be a very long and very costly and very complicated crisis playing out in Palestine, in Gaza, and the West Bank for, I would argue, the foreseeable future. Saudi Arabia is going to play a very important role in that, I would argue, from the United States' point of view. So Saudi is an important state. Oil is also a fuzzy topic in this discussion because for the Saudis, oil is the most important element of their economy. It's where they draw a great deal of their international power and their international importance. And it's something that they also are mindful of in the context of OPEC, right? OPEC is an organization of commercial oil producers. It's not meant to be a geopolitical institution, right? It's bound together by shared commercial economic concerns. And it's an organization in which Saudi Arabia acts as the de facto leader. So Saudi Arabia tends to be somewhat protective of its oil policy because it has to manage this policy in conjunction with the rest of OPEC. Even if it's the leader, it has to be mindful of the concerns of the other members of the group, because Saudi Arabia, I would argue, has been quite successful over the last 6 years in implementing market management strategies and cutting production to try to affect changes in the global oil price. And they've been able to do that largely by keeping OPEC together, OPEC plus, right? Also pulling in Russia. This has been a fairly successful strategy for Saudi Arabia. So for the United States to try to pull concessions on oil specifically, to try to get guarantees from Saudi Arabia to do XYZ on oil policy in exchange for these other concessions, I think we're not likely to see firm commitments on that front, simply because the issues under discussion don't really lend themselves to firm discussion the same way some of the other elements in the grand bargain do.
I'd love to talk a little bit about weaponizing these oil markets in the event of a great power conflict. We recently had Dr. Dale Copeland on our show to talk about global commerce, and he compared a lot of modern U.S.-China relations to America's oil embargo of Japan in the 1930s. If we were to talk about conflict between the U.S. and China, you know, America, as you described, has a lot of its important energy markets flowing through the North Atlantic. But on the other hand, I'm curious just about the precarity of China's access to energy resources. Like, in the event of a conflict, could the U.S. Navy plug up the Strait of Malacca? Or, you know, is China meaningfully diversifying to have access to Russian markets or Iranian markets?
Sure. That's a great question. It's a question I've actually been thinking about more lately. What would a crisis in the Taiwan Straits do to energy markets as opposed to what the crisis in the Red Sea has done? So I think when you look at Chinese energy policy, the Chinese are concerned about security and they're concerned about cost. And diversification is a way to address both of those concerns. So China, given the enormity of its energy demands and the diverse nature of those demands, right? They don't just need oil and gas and coal. They need lithium. They need other critical minerals. They have lots of inputs that they need to draw from lots of different sources. They're obviously the epicenter of global trade. So, you know, there's lots of points of friction that could be impeded or disrupted. Not just energy is just one, right? And it may not even be the most important, but it is, you know, it is one that draws a lot of attention. So as far as, like, in the event of a great power competition or great power struggle, I don't know if China or the United States can do a whole lot to one another in terms of an Achilles heel, because China does get most of its energy from sources that it regards as relatively secure. Russia is one that it could expand. It hasn't chosen to do so yet. You know, an interesting issue to think about is, like, what will happen to Russia as an energy producer the further and further we get away from 2022? You know, Russia possesses some of the world's largest accessible reserves of natural gas. And it's unclear whether it's going to be able to move any of that natural gas, because most of it went by pipeline and most of those pipelines went to Europe. And Europe isn't going to keep buying Russian gas. It's still buying a little bit, but it's going to move as quickly as it can toward not having to buy any at all. And once it reaches that point, Russia is going to be sitting on a lot of gas that it can't move. China could choose to build pipelines to import that gas. It would be incredibly expensive and it would be very time consuming. And it would maybe force China to rely a little bit more on Russia than China is really comfortable with doing. But it would be a way of diversifying energy access for China in a way that would be very difficult for the United States to disrupt. But my view is that given the diversification of energy ties connecting China to its sources, and given the fact that the United States certainly isn't energy independent and never will be, but it is arguably more secure in its energy consumption than it has been in several decades, you know, in the event of a great power competition between the United States and China, it would be difficult for either power to look at energy for key pressure points. You mentioned the Strait of Malacca. I mean, like, I'm no expert on the U.S. Navy, And I know that the U.S. Navy can do a lot. I don't know if it can plug up the Strait of Malacca in a way that would affect China specifically without bothering a whole lot of other people further down the supply chain. Right. If you plug up the Strait of Malacca, you're not just affecting China. You're affecting South Korea, Japan. You're affecting Taiwan, all of which are states that the United States wants to remain friendly with. So, you know, energy pressure points, given the changes in the global energy market that have taken place, are maybe not quite as clear as they were in the early days of the energy crisis.
Yeah, I remember we edited a lot of and published a lot of pieces about the naval side of this question, maybe about 10 years ago when the at the National Interest, when there was a lot of thought in naval circles about breaking into Chinese A2AD zones, which creates a lot of difficulty, requires a lot of expense, imposes a lot of costs on the Navy. And there was a search for an alternative, and TX Hams was kind of developing offshore control as a concept, which was basically economic siege on China through distant choke point control. And there was a lot of concern that it wouldn't be decisive. And it sounds like it maybe has gotten even more that way. But I wanted to pivot over toward toward Yemen. U.S. Yemen envoy Tim Lenderking seemed to imply in a recent press briefing that we would consider removing the Houthis from the specially designated global terrorist list in return for an end to Houthi attacks on Red Sea shipping. And just more broadly, there's starting to be a lot of questions in Washington about, is this Houthi disruption forever? Is there a way to resolve it? Because we've been bombing them on and off for a while. They've been shooting on and off for a while. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. The criteria that they've articulated, like, hey, Israel needs to get out of Gaza, seem like they're not going to be fulfilled anytime soon. It looks like the Israelis are settling in for the long haul. What do you make of what's going on and what options U.S. policymakers have?
I think the U.S. acknowledged from the very beginning that military power was not going to solve the problem in the Red Sea. You know, it was actually quite remarkable how blunt and frank U.S. officials, including President Biden himself, was about the efficacy of strikes on Houthi positions. There's been a little bit of commentary more recently, like, well, you know, the progress of the bombing has degraded Houthi capabilities. We're not seeing quite as many missile launches as we did. They're relying more on drones. You know, I took a look at the numbers, and I'm not totally sure that that plays out. The Houthis are still firing missiles at regular intervals. They still have that capability. It's unclear whether the military strikes have accomplished really anything. You know, I think the U.S. has to acknowledge two things. It has to acknowledge that the Houthis aren't going to go away. They're there. They can't be moved. The coalition of states that could have removed them is no longer feasible. You know, the Saudis and the Emiratis aren't going to go back in to fight in Yemen. And the United States certainly isn't going to put boots on the ground in Yemen to fight the Houthis. So defeating them on the ground doesn't seem likely. And the problem won't go away with a ceasefire in Gaza. The Houthis may cease their attacks because, you know, the war in Gaza has been their primary pretext. But if they continue to see gains to be made from firing at passing ships, which is all that it takes to continue the disruption, right? I mean, they've sunk one ship and they've damaged lots of other ships. But most of the disruption to shipping has come from shipping companies diverting traffic to avoid the risk of getting hit. You know, so for so long as the Houthis continue to represent a risk to shipping, the disruption will continue, even if the pace of their attacks slows. So even a ceasefire in Gaza is unlikely to solve the problem of how to end the Red Sea disruption. The problem will likely be solved through some kind of diplomatic effort, right? Through some kind of effort to bring peace to Yemen, to bring stability, to support the sovereign government in Yemen that continues to control the southern half of the country. The United States will have a role in that. Saudi Arabia will likely have a pretty considerable role in that as well. I would argue that other states that are being affected by this disruption should also play a role in managing the situation in Yemen, China being first on the list. China has managed to stay out of this crisis, despite having a squadron in the Red Sea, despite being heavily affected by the disruptions in traffic, being that, you know, they're one of the major markets connecting, being connected through shipping through the Red Sea. China hasn't seen any reason to get involved. And I would argue that they should get involved because they do have a role to play in managing this. Iran as well. Iran is a main backer of the Houthis. And I think a peace deal or a settlement that brings about a more stable situation in Yemen will have to incorporate some degree of Iranian involvement, because the Iranians have their own reasons for supporting the Houthis. So from the point of view of the United States, bombing doesn't accomplish a whole lot. I think that was acknowledged very early on. Diplomacy is probably the way to go, but diplomatic options are very, very limited while there remains fighting in Gaza. I think it does start with a ceasefire in Gaza, and that opens up the possibility for something more substantive.
I've heard talk in some circles, particularly from the Gulf, that this current conflict with the Houthis should prompt a reassessment of how we look back at the U.S. role in the Saudi-Emirati war in Yemen that's, you know, largely been resolved, truced away, that basically the United States should not have backed away from support because, look, the Houthis are clearly a problem. What do you make of that?
Yeah, no, I've seen very, very similar arguments. And I think the position from observers and commentators in the Gulf, particularly, is that these are chickens coming home to roost, that the Houthis were there, they were in Yemen, they were building this capability, that there was a window for addressing them, for defeating them, and that the United States, by pulling away or by refusing to back a war against the Houthis, sort of created the conflict, created the crisis as it's now resulted. And that for the Saudis, for the Gulf states, that this is sort of a failure of U.S. foreign policy, first and foremost. Now, counterfactuals are always tricky. Saying, you know, if this actor had done X rather than Y, then the result would have been A rather than B. You know, that's always tough to do. But I think it speaks to the degree of frustration that Gulf actors have towards the United States and U.S. policy in the region broadly. There's been a lot of dissatisfaction with how the United States has been approaching the Middle East over the last several years. A sense that there is a lack of coherence, that there's a lack of grand strategy, that there's a lack of real interest or concern, that a lot of what the United States is doing is kind of based on inertia or is based on past experience. And I think, you know, I think some of that is warranted from what we've seen from the last several administrations, including the Biden administration and its approach to Israel's war in Gaza. There's a lot of frustration with U.S. policy in the region. And until that policy becomes a little bit more coherent and coalesces around something that focuses on more clear, coherent strategic goals, then I think frustration being expressed, particularly from the Gulf, is to be expected. But, you know, pivoting back to the question of the Houthis, you know, this was a problem that existed, and it was a problem that the United States chose to ignore. It chose to ignore not only the growth and the consolidation of the Houthis in North Yemen, but it also largely chose to ignore the debilitating humanitarian crisis that has broken out in Yemen over the last several years. It's a crisis that the United States hasn't done enough to resolve, and it's one that will continue to demand attention and resources along with the crisis that has broken out in Gaza.
How do these crises fit together in Yemen? Because there's the U.S.-British Houthi confrontation, and then there's the legacy and kind of the truce arrangement made for the UAE-Saudi Houthi confrontation. And there's been concern that U.S. efforts in one could endanger the other, that you could see the either just the famines and things that accompanied the Yemeni civil war returning, or that you could see the Yemeni civil war returning, the Saudis and Emiratis getting dragged back in, et cetera. What do you think of that?
Sure. So I think the concern there is that the U.S. effort against the Houthis, which is designed to degrade or deter them from attacking shipping, will not only not do that, right? The Houthis will continue to attack shipping, but the Houthis will also expand the remit of their attacks to target tankers carrying Middle East energy products, which so far they've avoided attacking, or local energy infrastructure. And by that, the infrastructure not only in the Red Sea, but in the Persian Gulf, as they've done in the past. So that, I think, is the concern from the Gulf side, that the U.S. campaign against the Houthis will directly undermine Saudi and Emirati efforts to exit the war in Yemen by broadening Houthi attacks to hit local energy export infrastructure. I think right now the risk of that remains fairly low because I think the Houthis are remaining quite focused on their strategy of attacking shipping or attacking U.S. warships, which they've been doing quite frequently ever since the U.S. arrived in the region. Those are the enemies they want to fight. I don't think the Houthis are too keen to fight the Saudis and their Emiratis anymore. They regard that war as done and won from their point of view. So as far as, you know, where these two conflicts separate, the Saudis and the Emiratis are keen to exit the war in Yemen. What that means for the stability of the country and the survival odds of the government in South Yemen, I think, remain open for debate because that government relies on support, particularly from Saudi Arabia, to maintain its position. But what role the United States plays if the U.S. continues this military intervention, continues to bomb the Houthis, or continues to regard the Houthis as a threat that needs to be addressed, then I think it does raise the risk of confrontation between the U.S. and the Houthis expanding into something regional that pulls the Emiratis and the Saudis back in. That's not something that they want, but it might be something that's difficult to avoid if the U.S. continues its intervention in Yemen.
Dr. Gregory Brew, thank you for coming on Security Dilemma.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Apply to the JQAS Summer Conference by May 7th. Remember to rate and review on your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.